You're listening to Artists and Hackers, a podcast on art, code, and community. We talk to programmers, artists, poets, musicians, bot makers, educators, students, and now legal scholars in an effort to critically look at both online art making and the history of technology and the internet. We're interested in where we've been and speculative ideas on the future. In this season of the podcast, we're working with the Engelberg Center on Innovation Law and Policy at NYU Law to unpack some of the thorny issues for those working in art and code. In today's episode, I speak once again with Michael Weinberg, the director of the Engelberg Center on Innovation Law and Policy at NYU. In our earlier episode, we covered a range of legal issues pertaining to creators and artists working today. Then I asked what I thought was a fairly straightforward question about the creator of artwork generated through machine learning and generative AI, especially algorithms like OpenAI's product DALL-E. And I was amazed at the response when Michael began talking about the legal case called the Monkey Selfie case. First, we'll listen to our earlier conversation on the topic. Then I'm going to come back and speak with Michael again, where he gives some updates on the latest legal issues that have been seen in court relating to these cases. All right. So one of the strange things that's happening is artists and software writers, programmers, and other people are making tools that are used to make artwork. Let's say I make a tool. Maybe I make some new kind of digital painting software, or I write a machine learning library that others can use to generate poetry or plays or dances. What are some of the structures around what I can kind of specify in terms of who uses that software to make artwork? If I make this tool to make digital paintings, do I own the digital paintings that other artists that use my software make? Is there any restrictions that on the work that they make or that I can even say about what they make with my software?
First off, owning the copyright in a tool does not necessarily or automatically give you ownership in the things that are made with the tool, right? If I type something in Microsoft Word, if I write a book in Microsoft Word, Microsoft does not own my book. You know, we're using podcast recording software to record this interview. The company that makes the software to record the interview does not own a copyright in the podcast. And so, or the company that makes the editing software you use to edit everything together and remove all of my ums and stammers does not own the output, the thing that you create with the tools. Now, that distinction can feel like it breaks down a little bit when you have some of these, especially some of these machine learning based tools that feel like instead of a person using the tool to create a work, it's kind of the tool doing all of the work itself, and there isn't really a person involved. And there's a little bit of debate. I mean, there's a little bit of debate in legal world as to, you know, what should happen in that case. I think the best answer and the answer that has been the case up until now and probably will continue to be the case for the foreseeable future is that you need a person to have a copyright. And so if it is actually true that just a robot made whatever the work is, that's great. The work exists in the world, but the robot doesn't own the copyright. And this is actually very similar to a case that was high profile, or at least high profile in copyright legal nerd world a couple of years ago, where it was called the Monkey Selfie case. And it was a situation where there was a picture that went viral on the internet. And the story of the picture was that some monkeys had stolen a photographer's camera out of his bag and taken a bunch of pictures of themselves because they were or they'd come up to a camera because they were seeing their reflection in the lens, and they were kind of fascinated with it. And so they were taking pictures of themselves, basically. And so it went viral. The pictures were very cute. And then the photographer tried to assert copyright over the pictures. And the court, and ultimately this is, you know, the copyright office has put this in their big book of copyright rules. It's called the Compendium of Copyright. That, you know, the monkeys took the picture, but monkeys aren't people. And so monkeys can't have copyright. And so it feels like monkeys taking selfies is very different from an elaborate AI machine learning algorithm generating art. But I think the principle is the same, which is you need a person involved in order to be able to have a copyright in the first place. And there are lots of good reasons for that. One of which is if you want to use that photograph or the image or whatever was generated, you need a license from somebody. And, you know, a monkey can't give you a license, can't enter into a licensing agreement. A robot can't enter into a licensing agreement. So there just needs to be a person for the system to work at all.
What about the person that wrote the robot software? Or, I guess I'm trying to push at the limits here. I'm trying to figure out where does that end and the robot begins?
Yeah, right. No, I mean, this is a good question, right? And I think it becomes a little bit of a fact-specific question, right? If the person who wrote the software is really the driving creative force behind the output, then you can probably argue that the person who wrote the software is sort of working all the way through the process. If you can really draw a straight line between the person who wrote the software and the output, then maybe there's an argument for that. But in that case, the software isn't really a tool in the sense that, you know, a word processor is a tool, right? It's more kind of part of the work that they are doing. And it's a tool being manipulated by the creator as she's creating it, potentially. If someone creates a tool and then someone else comes along and uses the tool to achieve some sort of creative output, then in that case, it probably is the case that person who's using the tool is providing the creative spark. And so maybe they're the person who should own the copyright. And you can make up hypotheticals that really kind of draw really fine distinctions here. And those hypotheticals will probably pop up in reality over the next couple of years. But I think you still get to a situation where the fundamental question is, who is the person who is ultimately responsible for the creative spark behind this specific work?
And that's where we left off with monkey selfies and generative art in episode 20 when I spoke to Michael last year. But recently, he let me know that we finally have legal cases playing out in courts pertaining to the monkey selfie case. Ever since I'd last spoken to him, I'd been bringing up the story to family and at parties. I'm pretty sure my friends are sick of hearing about it. But now, the monkey selfie case is back in the news, at least the legal news, just as predicted. So I spoke again with Michael to find out the latest.
So I think the good news is that everything that we talked about earlier is still correct. And everything we talked about is still right. And these questions that we were talking about of the line between when the human is the creator and when the monkey or the AI or the machine is the creator are still really important questions and really key questions. And the thing that has changed since we last talked is that we've actually seen in the US, the US Copyright Office weigh in on some attempts to register copyrights for works that were created either by AI or in collaboration with AI. And so it gives us a little bit more context. It makes the hypotheticals a little bit more concrete to understand how the lines are drawn.
And what are some examples of these?
So there are two high-profile examples. One is an example where someone tried to register a picture that they said was made by their AI program, their generative AI program. And so they wanted to register the picture and the author, they wanted to be the generative AI program itself. So not someone who said, I made this by prompting generative AI, and therefore I want to be the owner of the copyright, but someone who said, I think the robot is the author, 100%. And the Copyright Office said, no, robots cannot be the authors. AI cannot be authors. You need a person in the process, touching on that monkey selfie case that we talked about before. And so it's clear right now that the U.S. Copyright Office position is that AI and, you know, robots or software alone cannot be the creator of a copyright-protected work. It can create paintings, but those paintings don't get, or anything else, but those paintings or anything else don't get copyright protection. They're just, right now, they're just in the public domain.
And can you say a little bit more about that? Did they explicitly state that that's the case, or just because it's not possible to copyright them, we or lawyers understand that to mean that it's in the public domain?
Yeah, I mean, they rejected the registration. They said it's not eligible for copyright protection. This is now being litigated. The person who submitted the work, the painting, is someone who is, I think it's safe to call him a kind of an activist who has tried to have his computer programs get patents in the past. He's someone who really wants his software to have the full scope of creative ability within the law. And so the Copyright Office was very explicit. They rejected the registration. They said that there is no, there's no human creator. And so this is not eligible for copyright protection. The person who tried to do it is sued and kind of appealed that. And it's now kicking around the appellate court. But it's been very explicit, right? If we're just talking about generative AI, there's no human. And so there's no human to own the copyright. No one owns the copyright in the work.
Does that have implications for how people use things like DALL-E?
I think it does. I think they're really potentially very interesting, because what it suggests pretty explicitly is that the works coming out of DALL-E are not eligible for copyright protection. The works coming out of DALL-E are in the public domain. And so right now we have this situation where we haven't had for like a century, where brand new works are entering the public domain directly. They're not being protected by copyright for any period of time. They're just generally available to anyone to do whatever they want with.
That's incredible. And I'm curious what the second legal case is that you had mentioned.
So the second legal case was a little bit more nuanced. This was someone who had made a graphic novel, and they had written the novel themselves, but they had basically turned to DALL-E or one of the other generative AIs to create the images in the graphic novel. And they had registered the graphic novel itself, and there was a little bit of back and forth, but eventually the Copyright Office rejected copyright registrations for the images. So the Copyright Office said, you, the person, did a lot of work. The generative AI was also very involved, but the generative AI doesn't get to be a co-author from a copyright standpoint. But you, as the person who wrote the book, you own the book. And also, if you think of the book, a graphic novel, as a compilation, or it's a thing that combines the text and those images are positioned on the page a specific way, they're kind of ordered in a specific way, that entire work you can be the sole author of, but you can't claim copyright in the images themselves, and the AI doesn't get copyright in the images themselves either. And so if someone else wants to come along and copy the entire book, they'll be infringing on the author's copyright. But if you take the images alone out of that graphic novel, those are not protected by copyright. Those are in the public domain. So this case is a little bit more of an example of that kind of collaborative approach that we had touched on. But it's still, you get in the same place, right? The parts of the creativity that the person was directly involved with, those are eligible for copyright protection. The parts where it's mostly generative AI, those are not eligible for copyright protection. And I think what we're going to see over the next couple of months and years is where that line is between, you know, the human parts and the generative AI parts.
Well, that's fascinating. Michael, thank you so much for updating us. Appreciate it.
Thank you so much.
This is the final episode of the season, which was made possible by support from the Engelberg Center on Innovation Law and Policy at NYU. Prior to this season, I had a more limited knowledge of the legal issues we covered, despite working in new media, art, and music for a really long time, and I thought that other folks would want to learn more as well. While we've only scratched the surface, we hope to cover more of these areas going forward, not only because new ethical, social, and legal issues constantly come up when working with new technology, but also because they, of course, suffuse our society overall today. I was genuinely surprised by the monkey selfie legal case, especially when Michael first presented the idea that a guidance relating to a monkey that cannot legally hold a copyright could be the key to interpreting legal decisions based on algorithms. So I was surprised again when Michael said this decision had been upheld, and the implication was that new generative works created through these kinds of machine learning algorithms are considered to be in the public domain, especially since we covered the public domain in episode 22, where we spoke with Brewster Kahle from the Internet Archive, and he spoke about the law of copyright being automatically applied to almost all works for 70 years after a creator's death even, unless an author explicitly waived or granted exemptions. In my first interview with Michael, he ended our conversation with an idea that has stuck with me. He said, "When you're making decisions, try and empower the good users and not spend a lot of time trying to limit the bad faith users. Think about who you want to be using this and how you want them to be using it, and put in place the licensing structure that allows them to do it." When I spoke with Dr. Jane Anderson and with Courtney Papani in episode 23, I was inspired by the innovative creation and testing of local contexts, which grows out of the needs of indigenous and local communities where they've been ignored or mistreated by unsupportive laws. It's an example of how communities are working to ensure their culture, community, and even their data are used or presented respectfully. Local contexts and initiatives like Creative Commons, free and open source, and ethical open source licenses are genuinely exciting, important tools that I hope will strengthen artists' and creators' work and help lead to the creation of healthy and supported creative communities. If you have a response to this episode or the season as a creative practitioner, researcher, or scholar, or you're working on new initiatives, licenses, and tools, please get in touch to let us know about it. This season of the podcast was produced with the Engelberg Center on Innovation, Law, and Policy at NYU. My name is Lee Tussman. Our audio producer is Max Ludlow. Our designer is Caleb Stone. All of the music on today's episode is by our audio engineer, Max Ludlow, with the tracks Body Memory, Pool, and Relic. You can find more episodes, full transcripts, and links to find out about our guests and topics on our website, artisanhackers.org. You can find us on Instagram at artisanhackers, Mastodon at artisanhackers@post.lurk.org, and you can always write to us on our website. Please leave us feedback wherever you get your podcasts. Thanks for listening.